specialized education in 4 easy steps. Visit carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.
Welcome to Generation Now, the show by and for millennials and Gen Z on WGTD 91.1 FM. I'm Troy McDonald. Thank you for spending a part of your Saturday morning with us. I was scrolling through YouTube when I discovered the work of our guest today. She articulates and describes our society's conversations about race and voter suppression in such a meticulous and methodical way that enlightened me to my own history as a young African-American man in a way that no high school teacher, no elementary teacher, no teacher, period, or expert ever has. She is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African-American Studies at Emory University. In 2016, she was named one of the thinkers and doers transforming America by Politico. She is also the author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, a New York Times bestseller. Please welcome to Generation Now the incomparable Dr. Carol Anderson. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Troy. Thank you.
So let's start the conversation with kind of describing what white rage is, because I think that kind of dovetails into everything we'll talk about.
Yes, and I think the best way to get at that is to get at it the way that I came to it. I was watching television in August of 2014, and on the news they were showing Ferguson blowing up, Ferguson, Missouri, after the killing of Michael Brown. And all of the pundits were saying the same thing. Look at all of this black rage. Look at black people burning up where they live. Can you believe black people are burning up where they live? Oh, my God, black people are burning up where they live. Black rage, black rage, black rage. And I had lived in Missouri for 13 years, and I was shaking my head going, that's not black rage, that's white rage. And then I went, wow. And it hit me that in this nation, we are so focused in on the flames that we miss the kindling. And the kindling, those are those policies that are systematically put in place to undermine the advancement of African Americans as they achieve their citizenship rights, their basic human rights, their civil rights.
Well, and I
can... And what do I mean by that? Mm-hmm. And so that white rage comes through the court systems as we see judicial decisions such as Plessy v. Ferguson, Shelby County v. Holder in 2013. It comes through in legislation. It's cool. It's methodical. It's not the violence that we're used to seeing and being outraged about, but it is the kind of quiet policy making that cuts, undercuts, undermines the full citizenship rights of African Americans as this struggle continues for these basic citizenship rights.
And you talk about the systemic and just ever-present policies. We have to discuss in that same vein, kind of localize it with Scott Walker, who was just replaced on Monday by Democrat Tony Evers. But he enacted voter ID laws, which you have said in numerous interviews and in your writing, that was indeed racist, was intentionally racist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think being in Wisconsin, this is a great place to start this conversation. All right. So, you know, in white rage, I talk about these moments of advancement coming out of the Civil War, the Great Migration, Brown, civil rights, and the election of Barack Obama. To understand the tenacity and the ferocity of voter ID laws, we have to understand how the election of a black man to the White House sent this tremor through the system. So one of the things we hear is, how racist can America be? Mm. We elected a black man to the White House twice. But no, we did not, because in saying that in that way, it's to say, how racist can whites in America be because we whites elected a black man. But not since 1964 have the majority of whites, and 64 is an important date because that's the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
Not since 1964 have the majority of whites who voted for a Democratic candidate for president.
Mm.
And so with the election of Barack Obama, you didn't have a majority of whites vote for him. You had a sizable number, but you had an incredible coalition that came to the fore because of his incredible organizing and ground game of 15 million new voters, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, young, and the poor. Now, when you begin to think about voter ID laws, they systematically go after that group. And the way that it works is that it seems innocuous.
Right, and most sensible people.
Reasonable.
Right, most sensible
given
people.
Given the kind of Reichstag fire that they talk about, they, basically the Republicans, in terms of massive rampant voter fraud. So they generate this fear about massive rampant voter fraud undermining American democracy, when in fact that lie of voter fraud is then used to implement policies to undermine democracy.
How the
voter ID law works.
Right, and most people believe that it's sensible, right? I mean, you need an ID to go to the library, to do basic things. Why isn't that such a great ideal to hold our democracy to, right? That everyone should get an ID. And you have made it clear, you know, in cases in states where they closed the Department of Motor Vehicles and put hurdle after hurdle after hurdle, like it's the Olympics, for people
right.
to jump
okay.
over.
And the thing is that you cannot use your library ID to vote.
Right.
But this is why it seems so innocuous. Because they just say, oh, your voter ID, you just need an ID. And people go, oh, everybody's got an ID. One, everybody does not have an ID. Two, not everybody has the kinds of IDs that the legislatures, these Republican-dominated legislatures, write into the law as being the ticket to be able to get in to vote. And like places like North Carolina figured out what types of IDs African Americans had and didn't have, and then wrote the law to privilege those that African Americans did not have. What they did in Alabama was they said you need a government-issued photo ID to vote. And the Legal Defense Fund, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, looked up and said, okay, you need government-issued photo ID, but we see you don't have public housing ID on here. And they said, no, that one doesn't count. But let's think about it. Does it get more government-issued than public housing?
No, it does not.
Right? But in Alabama, 71% of those in public housing are African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And for many, that's the only ID they have. And so if you eliminate the kinds of IDs that African Americans have, then you're able to eliminate African Americans from the voting booth.
Hmm. Well, we talked about, you know, Scott Walker, who in this state closed down or changed the hours of the DMV. How did that kind of policy take place right here in Wisconsin? Take hold.
And so what you see happening in Wisconsin, so they made it clear, they again, Scott Walker and company, that they were going after Milwaukee, where 70% of the state's African American population lives, and they were going after the college campuses because they think college students are too liberal. So what you do is, and so again, you see this, identifying, and it's taking what they think are the characteristics of those, because the law says the 15th Amendment is really clear. You cannot discriminate on account of race.
Right.
And so they can't say, oh, we don't want black people to vote, because even that's too blatant for them. so they take the societally imposed characteristics, and so you start shutting down the hours when people can get to the Department of Motor Vehicles. So if you begin to limit the hours, and you know you have a working class population that has to punch the clock, and then you limit the hours when that working class population is actually working so they can't get to the place, that'll work. Or you begin to move those places away from and off of public transportation, because also what we know is that there's a racial disparity in terms of access to privately owned vehicles. Mm-hmm. We've got this data. And by limiting the access, and then even when the courts come in and say, come on, son. Now, you know, of course, they wrote it much more judicially, but they were basically saying, come on. Then what we also know is that by creating confusion in a time-constrained population, so I don't know whether this ID will work. I don't know what I need. I don't know if I can get there. I don't know. By creating that kind of confusion, it also depresses voter turnout. So what we saw in 2016 is that in Wisconsin, there were 60,000 fewer votes cast in the 2016 election than there were in the 2012 presidential election. 60,000. 68% of that decline came out of Milwaukee alone.
Hmm.
Trump won Wisconsin by barely over 20-some thousand votes.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you can, it's right there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to push back on that, because some people mm-hmm. might say, well, Tony Evers was just elected as the Democrat here, won with 47,000 surplus votes from Milwaukee. That kind of pushed him over the edge. So was the problem in 2016 not just you know, the disenfranchisement, obviously, that you so eloquently laid out, but the fact that there wasn't an interesting candidate there in that particular election at the presidential level at least.
Right, and that is part of the rebuttal. And so let me answer that. In 2016, that was the first election where we didn't have, the protection of the Voting Rights Act, but you also saw the full kind of implementation of the, across the nation, of these voter suppression laws in over 30 states. After that stunning voter suppression and Russian-aided victory for Donald Trump, then you had massive grassroots mobilization. Because now it's like, oh, wow, these folks really don't play fair, really don't play fair. So you have organizations like Vote Riders who are like, okay, we're not even going to argue about the pros and cons of voter ID. We're just going to do the heavy lifting to get people the ID that they need. And so that means if we need birth certificates, we're going to go the long haul to get people to get people to the places where they can get their birth certificates so that then they can get the ID that they need in order to vote. And so what you saw happening was massive grassroots mobilization to overcome the voter suppression tactics and laws that have been put in place. So it wasn't like, oh, 2018 shows that voter suppression doesn't work. In fact, what it shows is that you need massive mobilization at the grassroots level to overcome the voter suppression tactics that are put in place to suppress the voting rights of American citizens.
There was a state in the South, and it jogs my memory at this point, but where they had the state define the moral turpitude clause. And
Alabama,
thank you. and figured out a way to have mugshots be used as photo ID.
Right.
Yeah, just fast. I mean, so you're right, but it took a lot of effort and dedicated organizations down there in Alabama during the Roy Moore and Doug Jones election.
Yes, Yes, I mean, and that's, and so let me do a brief kind of piece on that. In 1901, Alabama, in its Jim Crow Constitution, it rewrote its Constitution to embed these kinds of Jim Crow laws in there. One of them dealt with felony disfranchisement. And it said, if you have been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, you have lost your right to vote. And if you try to vote, if you have been convicted of a crime, you will be charged with another felony and thrown in jail. Wow. Mm. Now, there is no law in the books called moral turpitude. So folks don't know that if they've been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude or not. And so what that did, and you have organizations going in, going, suing the state, define it. It took decades of lawsuits. Finally, in 2017, remember, this has been on the books since 1901.
Jesus.
In 2017, Alabama finally passed a law that defined moral turpitude. By that time, 8% of Alabama's adult population could not vote. 15% of its black population could not vote because of this moral turpitude statute. Once moral turpitude was defined, rape, murder, treason, the biggies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not drug crimes. Then these organizations turned to the Secretary of State and they said, okay, all of those folks that you told they had lost their voting rights, now go and tell them that they actually have them. And he said, I don't think that's a good use of state resources.
Mm.
So then you have grassroots organizations and civil society then doing the heavy lifting of democracy, informing all of these people that they may actually have the right to vote, and then getting them registered. But the state was like, we don't see any need in doing that.
So we're going to punish, indirectly punish them, I mean, for the victory of defining moral turpitude. So we defined it, but, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And like you say in so many of your talks, this is not the Klan. This is not cross-burning. This is done by people in respected positions of power, at least as we define them today, in the United States government.
And so think about respectable folk stopping 15% of the adult black population from voting. Now, if we saw that, and that's what I mean by we're so focused in on the flames that we miss the kindling. So if this was a massive Klan march, and we had cross burnings and folks in sheets and tiki torches, we'd have the cameras on there going, oh my gosh. But because these are these little quiet laws where people are just systematically and quietly removed, separated from their basic right to vote, we don't see it.
Hmm.
It's the same, the Brennan Center did a study and found, for instance, with voter roll purges, that millions of people had been removed from the voting rolls. Yet we don't see, it's not like we see the chalk outlines of those bodies,
mm-hmm.
of their electoral bodies. And so it just quietly happened.
But to push back, is that part of our fault, not just African Americans, but society, because we're so mm-hmm. drawn to the flames that we ignore a lot of this stuff?
Yes. And that's so I get these questions after my talks on white rage when I'm going around the nation. And I get the, what can we do? And there's several things that we can do. But one of them is to understand that the price of democracy really is eternal vigilance.
Mm.
And that we hear this language of, you know, we have to protect. How? Really? What's the impact? You know, we don't ask the questions because we're not even paying attention as these laws are coming forth. Hmm. But they do damage, and that requires us to be vigilant. When we're not vigilant, bad things happen.
Hmm. And we're talking kind of about, you know, how different, you know, different ways that we can go about solving this issue. But there is a debate within the black community. Just this week, there was a Tennessee judge who said that black men killing each other are being more successful at killing black men than the KKK ever has. And the NAACP in that area came out in support of the judge who said that, while Black Lives Matter activists, who tend to be, you know, millennials my age, were kind of, you know, up in arms about the NAACP support. So can you talk about the divide between kind of millennial African Americans and the way they go about solving these issues and kind of the traditional NAACP and those kinds of organizations and how they're viewing how we tackle these issues?
Okay. You mean old folk my age?
No.
And so this is also where I think we need to be more nuanced. So the NAACP, for instance, in Alabama, during that Doug Jones, Roy Moore election, they were central to the fight against voter suppression, against racism. The way they mobilized was amazing. But that Alabama NAACP may not be the other NAACP. So mm-hmm. we've got to be careful as we talk about the ways that these organizations respond. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, NAACP has thousands of branches, and they've got 50 state organizations. But you've got a framing. And I think part of the problem is that we see things sometimes too Manichaean. Mm. It's either this or that, when it can be some of both, and we need to be working on all of it. And that judge, Lord help him. You know, I'm in Atlanta now. I'm from the Midwest.
Oh, really?
But since I live in Atlanta, I can really go Southern. Bless his heart.
Right. Where, if you don't mind me asking, where are you from in the Midwest?
Ohio.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, Ohio. Yeah.
And
the kind of sense of there, let me back up, because we're dealing also with these kinds of stereotype tropes that I've got to work through.
Mm-hmm.
So the trope of black on black crime, right?
Mm-hmm.
Black folk kill black folk. And there is enormous grief within the community, and that grief is often overlooked in the broader white society. It's like black folk don't mind killing black folk because, you know, it's not like they grieve. It's like during slavery times when babies would be yanked away from their mothers. Well, you know, black mothers don't care about their kids. So this is really no big deal. Those kinds of tropes that deal with the anesthetization of feelings in the black community help them create policies that are cool with the deaths. Then you get the kinds of frustration from old folk, how's that? Who are like, we got to stop killing each other, but we've got to look at a lot of the structural issues beneath those killings. And we also have to look at the reality, you know, because you get black-on-black crime as this kind of trope that's the same as saying black kids don't care about school, the same about talking about black rage, look at them burning up where they live, this narrative of black pathology.
That we almost believe ourselves, so.
Yes, that we take in ourselves. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I started the introduction in White Rage, is where I began to destabilize those myths of black pathology. And let me just, so what we don't take into account when we talk about black on black crime as evidence of black pathology, whites who are killed, most of them are killed by other whites. But you don't hear the narrative of white-on-white crime. Hmm. And it's over 80-some percent of whites are killed by other whites. Just like over 80% of blacks are killed by other blacks. So there is work that narrative of black-on-black crime is doing to reinforce the narrative of black pathology.
And you almost, I think Michael Eric Dyson says that, very famed professor, he says, people kill where they live.
Yes.
And so
yes.
If you're going to talk about black on black crime, you have to talk about.
You see, right. And I think as well, we also have to be cognizant of is that there have always been these kinds of generational divides. And so we cannot treat them as unique or this is the first time this has happened. So back in the 60s, SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, led by Martin Luther King, was having major battles with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. SNCC looked at SCLC as a bunch of old heads. Right? And they called King the Lord. What the Lord gonna do now? So it's really, you know, when you're in the moment, you're like, God, the NAACP. God, the Black Lives Matter. This is standard. We have to understand that it's standard, and we also have to understand that when you're fighting these multiple fronts of violence, of discriminatory violence, of citizenship denial, of basic gutting of your human rights, that there are so many fronts on which to fight that we need everybody out there fighting in their way.
And that's interesting because everyone wants to be right, and so everyone thinks they have the right solution. And so you're saying that there can be multiple rights here? This is mind-blowing for a millennial that always has to be right.
Right. There are multiple rights. So for instance, you know, one of the battles that happened previously was this battle between protesting, this kind of direct action protesting, sit-ins, marching, and that this is the way. Then there was like an NAACP group that, and you had NAACP marching in it, but you also had going through the courts. Neither one of those is wrong. You need both. Yeah.
What worries you, kind of want to tail back to 2020 and kind of voter suppression. What worries you the most about 2020?
So much. One is that, which was the old Southern saying, a dying mule kicks hardest. Hey, I am in the South right now. I can say that. when you saw what the Wisconsin legislature did in its lame duck session, is that those kinds of efforts to weaken democracy, to weaken the ability of people to have a voice in their government, the ability to weaken the rights of people to choose their representatives. That battle will continue.
A huge thank you to Dr. Carol Anderson for being here, the author of White Rage and One Person, No Vote. There is so much more of this conversation that you just have to listen to. It's going to be archived on our website, WGTD.org. We talk about the Brown versus Board of Education decision that has local ramifications even to this very day. We talk about the Trump presidency and how we all can be more active and engaged citizens, no matter what party affiliation that you may believe in or subscribe to. So it's just a fascinating conversation. I hope that you will listen to the full interview on our website at WGTD.org. Have a great rest of your day. We'll see you next time on Generation Now. Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Old House Funeral Home. Has your spouse died? Attend Grief Share, Loss of a Spouse, February 13th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., 2022 52nd Street, PiasseckiAltHouse.com.
This is WG.